Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Our lives are not our own. From womb to tomb, we are bound to others. Past and present. And by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss films that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have slipped under the radar. Today, we're going to be talking about the 2012 film Cloud Atlas, written and directed by the Wachowskis and Tom Twilliker, based on the 2004 novel by David Mitchell. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and joining me today is a special guest co-host, the long-awaited return of one Mr. Alan Torres. Alan, how's it going, man?
Hey, what's up, man? Thank you so much for having me back. Hey, everybody, how's it going? Hope everybody's doing well. See a lot of changes around here. What's going on?
Yeah, it's good to have you back, man. It's exciting to hear your voice on the pod again. So thanks for stepping away from your hiatus and returning to the show and talking about this one that we had actually been meaning to talk about for a while. So I was like, let me get Alan back on here, because I know you and I had kicked it around for a while, wanting to talk about this one, going back to when we were talking about all those big swing movies. But yeah, you know, for anyone who's not aware, like I said, this is I don't even know what genre to call it, because it's basically six genres, because it's six interlocking stories directed by the Wachowski siblings and Tom Twilliker. And they basically needed two teams to direct those six interlocking stories. And I'll just say some of the cast here, and all of these cast members play two to six parts. Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Hugo Weaving, Jim Sturgis, Duna Bay, Ben Whishaw, James Darcy, Zhou Jun, Keith David, Susan Sarandon, and Hugh Grant. And if that's not a star-studded cast, I don't know what is. But yeah, Alan, we'll go to you first. What do you think of this one?
I remember I saw this when it came out, and it was nice to rewatch it, because when I first saw it, I was a little like, I feel like the ending, I was like, all right, I get it. But I feel like there was just so much going on. There was so much, like, it's such a fast paced movie, especially clocking in at like almost 3 hours, like literally just a couple minutes shy. And I enjoyed it when I saw it, but I kind of had this, like, I need to rewatch this, because I can't give it an absolute 100% my complete review on it. So watching it this time around, I was like, cool, like, I got it now. I was able to take it all in a lot better, especially where there's, like, I feel like on the second viewing, the pacing is much better. Like, I feel like you take everything in a lot easier. You appreciate all the characters and all the... I know people aren't fans of the makeup, but I will say there was times where, like, the makeup was pretty good, and then obviously there was the times, you know, Neo Soul makeup is a little rough at times. Totally understand that reasoning, but no, for the most part, I really dug it. And I don't know, I feel like I'm very shocked that it didn't do as well as it did back then. I feel like nowadays it might do a lot better, especially with a lot of movies being a lot longer now. Now it's kind of going into vogue of like longer films, you know, like Martin Scorsese has a couple of movies that are like almost clocking at 3 hours. I think
yeah, Killers of the Flower Moon is 3.5. It's out in theaters right now.
I was about to say that one. I think is like 3.5. Irishman is what, like 4 mm-hmm. hours?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. And yeah, I really dug it a lot. I love that some of the actors played, I think one of my favorite roles was Hugh Grant playing like the tribesman or whatever, like the
The cannibal warriors, guy?
The cannibals, yeah, like that shit was sick. I like that some actors, you got to finally see him in like slightly different roles than usual. Because Hugh Grant, I feel like 90% of his like filmography is just him being like a romantic dude or just like a kind of scummy British guy sometimes. And in this, it's like, it's cool to see him like a cannibal and he's just different. All the makeup and everything. He looks super fucking rad, where I was like, dude, that's awesome. And then Tom Hanks trying his best at a British accent or Scottish accent every now and again, where I was like, okay, cool. I mean, they can't all be bangers, but hey, man, you got six characters. So
better than any accent he did in Elvis or Pinocchio. I'll say that.
I haven't seen Pinocchio. Been wanting to, but I've been a little nervous about it.
But it's bad. It's bad. It's really bad. The Zemeckis one is don't watch it.
How did he do, man? Zemeckis was on top of the world at one point. And with this, I'm like, God damn, dude. But I don't know. The Disney live actions are a whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
But I like the story. I feel like, I'm not going to lie, I feel like I still might need to watch it one more time just to get, because I feel, I think the beginning of the film just goes, it lands on the ground running and it kind of doesn't let you breathe for a little while. I think not till like the hour mark, that first hour mark, you're like, okay, all right, it's slowing down a little bit. All right, you're trying to get your bearings and everything. But then the pacing gets better. I think it needs to do that at first. But it's such a huge film. Like you said, it is a massive swing of a film. It's trying to do six stories in 3 hours. And even then, I feel like it probably needed like 2 more hours. Maybe even three. Or 3 more, yeah. Like, I mean, you know what? I will say, I was talking to my girlfriend about it. She was a huge fan of Sense8. And I feel like Sense8, you know, unfortunately got canceled and all that. She was a big fan of it. I never really saw much of it. But she said that she was like, this was what I think they were trying to do with Cloud Atlas. And I feel like Cloud Atlas was probably them figuring it out. And then just Sense8 was just so much easier. Because they kind of have similar, you know, themes, you know, with like, it's not multiple lives in Sense8, but it's like multiple people and different lives in a way and interpreting it kind of thing. So, yeah, I really appreciate what they were trying to do with this movie. Because, like, I want to see more things like this nowadays, more where they're like, fuck it, dude, let's just try something wild like this. Like, the I don't even know how big the budget was, but, like, because at one point it's like a sci-fi epic, and then it's just like, you know, an ocean epic, and then at another point it's like wilderness. I mean, obviously, but it's just so impressive in scale, like, when you think about it.
Yeah, I think it was about $100 million budget on this one, which makes it one of the most expensive independent, or maybe like 130, closer to that. But it's either way, it's one of the most expensive independent films ever made. And there kept being points when they were like, we're going to run out of money. And basically, like, Tom Hanks would be like, hold on, let me just call these people. And like, the Wachowskis would be like, are we going to be able to film today? And they were like, wait, we got some more. We got an infusion of some other money. We can keep going. And that was something that regularly happened.
Tom Hanks just fucking puts a mustache on, goes to Disney, and he's like, I'm back. It's me, Walt. I need some money for some picture I'm working on. And they're like, oh, Walt's back, guys. All right, here you go. It's Mr. Banks himself.
Exactly. No, but, you know, you really said it. Like, I think this movie is probably one of the most ambitious films ever made. It just in terms of its massive, intense scope. And yeah, that beginning, because it basically has to introduce you to six storylines that are on the surface not connected at all, but are actually very connected. And the way you just kind of have to keep going with that, because they have to like be like, all right, here's these guys, here's these guys, here's these guys. And you have to take in so much information, so many characters. And I think that the way this film is edited makes that so much more palatable, because it is really clipping back and forth between them. And I think the score also does a lot of heavy lifting. It doesn't ever feel like the score is like, well, now it's going to sound like ocean-y, and now it's going to sound sci-fi. It's all kind of part of a piece. And then having, of course, the actors playing all those different roles really helps you feel like you're not getting any tonal whiplash, despite there being complete tonal differences between each story, because you'll have stuff like, you know, you'll have an actor saying something and then it'll cut to them in a completely different time period as a completely different person. And your brain kind of clicks it and connects it. And thematically, a lot of those moments are connected. You know, one I remember seeing early on is the, probably going to mispronounce his name, David Gayasi, who, you know, he plays the slave character in the Pacific Island storyline. And he's playing like a captain of this futuristic ship on the ocean in the post-apocalyptic timeline. And I'm like, that's just a cool moment that it's like, yeah, just seeing the way that they are able to weave all of these things together, I think was really just, they were just going for it. And I think even if the film hadn't succeeded, I think like it would still be like massively impressive. But for me, it really did succeed. And me, because I watched this thing in theaters multiple times, because I was working at a theater at the time, and I kept being like, I have to go back. I have to catch like every little thing. I have to figure out how this is all connected. And at a certain point, I'm like, oh, are they, like, because in the book, apparently, like, you know, there's the star that is like, or the comet that is, they all have birthmarks. It's like, okay, maybe the main character is like a reincarnation, you know?
The JoJo scar, the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure scar. The whole time I kept thinking about JoJo, because that's a similar thing in the anime where like they have like a star right here. Mm-hmm. On the back of their neck, and like, because it's over generations of time. So I kept looking at that, and I was just like, everything's a fucking JoJo reference at this point now. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, but, and then, you know, so, but that doesn't always completely line up. And it's the same thing with like characters playing or actors playing different characters. Like, nothing really lines up completely. So you're like, oh, it's kind of reincarnation, but it's kind of just saying, just generally, like, everyone is always connected. Like, these, and that's one thing they keep turning back to, and there's all these great monologues. There's like two or three in the film where they are just like, these things that we think divide us, these boundaries, they're all just made up bullshit. These hierarchies that have existed throughout history and will exist in some form probably in the future, they just need to come down. They're all nonsense. And you mentioned the makeup, and you know, especially in the new Neo Soul section, I totally understand why people are like, this is not cool. But I think that, and you know, so if like that doesn't work for people, I get it. But like, I think the reason it's so important and impactful to have all these characters doing all this stuff is because it's just saying that like, these distinctions that we make are just not, they don't matter. These boundaries, these lines that we draw in the sand, that's like, you're this, you're this, you're this. Whether it's like ethnicity or gender or religion or upbringing or whatever, they're all just and I think it really, like, you know, Halle Berry talked about in shooting this movie. And by the way, Halle Berry, who is in every single one, she's one of the two or three actors that is in all parts. You know, she plays, her characters' names are Native Woman in the first storyline. She's Jocasta Ayers, Louisa Ray. Then Indian Party Guest is the what she's identified as in the credits in the London 2012 sequence. Ovid, who is that older Korean guy with like the robotic eye.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, I waited for the credits again.
The credits
show you who they play. Yeah. And I was like, fuck, I didn't, like, even this time around, I was like, that was her? Or that, like, Susan Sarandon as well played like a male character. And I can't remember who else, but yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and then, you know, of course, you know, you have Hugo Weaving playing Miss Noakes, and, you know, and then she plays, And there's a few of those, you know, like Ben Whishaw plays Georgette, who's, you know, the person that, the wife of Cavendish's sister-in-law, I should say, that he had the affair with. That's Ben Whishaw, and so there's a lot
That's the one where Hugh Grant puts the guy in the old people home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, I didn't see her. I didn't see him as her for the first time, but like when he's laying in bed, and he's like, he sends his love or whatever. Right after he like trapped him into the old folks home. And I was like, who the fuck is that? And then in the credits when I showed him, I was like, of course that fucker looks gorgeous as a woman too. I'm not gonna lie, after, was it Casino Royale or Quantum of Solace?
Oh yeah, yeah.
When he first shows up as Q, as Quartermaster, I remember I was like, that guy is gorgeous. Like Ben Whishaw, I kind of have a bit of a guy crush on him. So when I saw him in the credits, I was like, oh my fucking God, look at him again. He's still hot, but yeah.
Yeah. And I love that moment when he's like, you know, it's the 70s version of him, and he's just been like listening to the Cloud Atlas Quartet that was written by him, like in the 30s, like the other character played by him in the 30s.
Oh yeah, duh. That didn't even click. That's right.
And there's so much stuff like that, and some of it's characters, some of it's stuff like a lot of stuff they'll show you like earlier on, like the thing where they see the clip from the movie that would eventually be adapted into the harrowing affair of Timothy Cavendish or whatever it's called, and they just see that one clip, and it's like Tom Hanks playing the part, and then you see the actual line as it happened like later on, and there's a lot of like call forwards almost. And like one that I really stuck with was the button, which, you know, was like there was like the thing that Tom Hanks is trying to steal from the Adam Ewing in Jim Sturgis. Right? Yeah, in the first one, he steals that button, and then that button actually comes back. He finds it in the last segment. That's what he makes into his little necklace, and that's finally when he finally breaks free at the end. It pops off, and he's kind of finally. You know, that thing that harkens back to him being this evil character that was trying to steal us, and he is finally able to lose that. I think that was such a cool moment. But going back to what I was saying, like Halle Berry.
Oh, also, real fast, the button. Because Tom Hanks plays the publisher's character in a movie.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, when the old people are trying to leave the old folks home, when they steal the Range Rover, they're trying to figure out how to escape. How do they escape? They figure out the button.
Yeah, there you go.
So there you go. Yeah, you're right. It's all like connected. And yeah, holy shit. God damn. Yeah. So yeah, I need to rewatch it again.
Because yeah, I watched it. I watched it a couple nights ago, and then I watched it again just like, you know, an hour ago. I finished it because there's so much stuff. Like you can't possibly get all of it. And and then to, you know, go back to what I was saying about Halle Berry. And then, you know, of course, the last part she plays is the character of, her name is Marinum, who is, you know, she's like one of those like future people that floats around in the boats that comes to the island or whatever. She talked about, like, she's like, yeah, these, I would never get to play a lot of these parts. And, you know, so that's, I think that's so cool. It's like, oh yeah, she's all these characters, like the boundaries of just, oh yeah, you can be this, but you can't be this. Like you have all of these characters doing all these things. And it's just showing that, yeah, we are all humans. These boundaries that we put up are completely made up. And I think it's very telling that this comes from the Wachowskis, who are both trans women, you know, like they are kind of like, these boundaries of gender that we've been put into are bullshit. And they trans, and it's interesting because at the time of filming, one of them, I believe it was Lily, had transitioned, but Lana had not yet. I might be mixing that up.
I think it's reverse. I think Lana came first and then it was Lily.
Okay.
I want to say that's how it was.
And so, you know, I think that's very telling that it is coming from these two directors who have had this experience, you know, and are, and because that, you know, the book is also like where it's all these different interlocking stories. The book is kind of done like a Russian nesting doll where like the first chapter and the last chapter are like the Adam Ewing one. And then like the second and second last are like the 30s one. And it kind of like goes to like
They're like bookends, pretty much.
Yeah, like the middle chapter is the only one that's like not split in half, and that's the one with the true, you know, and all that.
Oh,
so
when you finish, I want to get to that.
But it really was really difficult to adapt, and you know, it's something that, you know, I haven't actually ever, I don't think, mentioned this on the show. I mentioned it, you know, like you in real life before, but you know, like me being non-binary, it was something that I was just like, yeah, all these conventions that I, because that's one thing I always think of, is just like, I fucking think gender norms are so dumb and it's all bullshit. And so that was something that, you know, really resonated with me watching it recently, something I didn't even think about back the first time I watched it, but it really affected me in that matter. But yeah, what did you want to say about the true?
Oh man. So you said This was written by the Wachowskis, and then I think it was like
Tom Twilliker, yeah, who also did. People know him from Run Lola Run. It's probably his most famous thing. He's a German guy.
Well, I think there was a secret writer in this. And okay. I think he focused on that part, the Tom Hanks like island goat herder. And his name, I think, is Frank Miller.
Okay.
Because it finally fucking dawned on me, dude. The first time I saw this movie, I was like, why does this fucking like dialect sound so fucking familiar? And I couldn't figure it out then. And then when I watched it again, it's when they said true. And it finally clicked. And I was like, these fuckers talk like the mutants and the Dark Knight Returns. And I couldn't, they finally fucking blew my mind up. And I was just like, these people evolved from the mutants from the Dark Knight Returns. That's going to be my headcanon. Somehow, some fucking shit happened because they sound like the mutant leader. And then they sound like the two. I don't know if you've ever read it or watched the animated films.
I haven't, no.
Go fucking watch part one and part two. Phenomenal fucking films. I mean, it's one of the greatest graphic novels of all time anyways. But go and watch them when you get the chance and fucking tell me that they don't sound exactly the same. Especially there's these two mutant guys. I forgot their names, like Bob and some shit. And they just talk like that. They're like, the bat ain't around here. That's no way. That's not true. Hey, man, you can't be talking skizzing like that or whatever the fuck. And they're doing that shit. And I was like, oh, my God. This is all Dark Knight fucking Returns, dude. So, yeah, that had me fucking dying. Right when I had that, like, that clarity came in, I was like, oh, this is the Dark Knight Returns future right here. But anyways, just, you know, I hope your listeners pick up on that and be like, oh my God, he's right. But yeah, I just had to say it, dude. It was fucking cracking me up. I was like, oh my God, that's what it is. And the mutant leader too, when he's like fights Batman in the mud, he talks the same fucking way too. He's like, this cousin, bro, or fucking, I'm going to give you an assy whooping or whatever the fuck they talk. I just was like, oh man. But yeah, that had me dying. But anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah, no, well, I usually don't break down plot here, and I'm definitely not going to break down the entire plot of this movie because that would be insane and ridiculous, but I do want to at least, because I mentioned the six stories, and I at least want to, I touched on them earlier, but I want to say what they are, and those are, and these are also like, let's see, yeah, the names of the chapters in the book's titles, because basically each, and this is the convention of the book, but it's also something that happens in here where each one they're like reading or like watching something from the past storyline. So each timeline is there, like, you know, in the first one, he's reading the diary of the guy from the earlier time, or, and then Louisa Ray, her story gets turned into like a mystery novel, and Jim Broadbent's reading that. We already talked about like how his thing gets turned into a movie. And then Song Mi, her whole thing becomes this huge, basically thing that almost founds a religion. She helps to, it's like a replicant-esque figures kind of like help overturn this world order. But so it's the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, Letters from Zeldheim, Half Lies, the First Louisa Ray Mystery, The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish, Orison of Sonmi 451, and Sluches Crossing and Everything After are the six kind of storylines that interweave back and forth here. But yeah, what were you going
to
say?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I always wanted to read the book. I remember always seeing it when we worked together. I'd always kind of pass by, but that's a huge book, so I was kind of like, you know.
Yeah, I tried to read it a while back. It's pretty dense, and it's not an easy read. And I thought about trying to read it again in anticipation of this podcast, but I just ran out of time. I did not have time to read that book because it's written like Dracula, you know, where like how Dracula is like, here's letters and stuff like that. It's the same thing where it's like, it's you know, all these different traditions and stuff like that. And yeah, that being, you know, the kind of conceit of both the book and the movie, I think really lends itself well to the kind of way saying that everyone is interconnected, and that one of the last lines of the movie, it's the last one before that kind of little epilogue that you get where he talks about just being a drop in, he was like, nothing you do will amount to more than a drop in the ocean. He's like, well, what is an ocean if not just a large amount of drops or whatever. I can't remember the exact line, but you know, it's kind of saying that like these little things that we do have huge replications that when multiply, it's like the butterfly effect, like over the years, like you influence one person and then they influence somebody else and it just goes down the line. So with talking about all these different parts, these different time periods, these different story settings, which one, did you have a favorite one?
I don't think I had a favorite one. I think I kind of liked the chaos of it all. Like maybe it's because we have been so accustomed. Maybe they needed to wait a little bit because we're so accustomed to going on our fucking phones, being on TikTok and Instagram, and you look at the next thing over, and you go to the next one so fast, the next video or the next meme or whatever the fuck. I kind of liked that kind of part of it. Like, I don't know, I liked that it was so chaotic and so fast. I just kind of was like, the whole movie's my favorite, I guess. Like, the whole thing. Yeah. I guess. I will say I had favorite characters from each one, but yeah, I don't know. Like, it's probably a basic answer, but yeah, I really dug them all.
No, I mean, I think that's fair because, and, you know, like I said, despite them being so different and, you know, literally different director teams and stuff like that, they all feel of a piece to the point where, you know, when there will be the rising action and it'll be cutting between the different ones, it'll be kind of like the same, like there's an escape scene happening and it's like, the old people are escaping the home, but then it's at the same time the Duna Bay character is in the future, like on that little like extendable ramp thing, while the plane is shooting at her, and like it's all kind of coming together. And one, I think probably you mentioned favorite characters. I definitely had some favorite characters too, and Sonmi, like I think Duna Bay is so like incredible in this. She and I know she shows up in Sense8 too. And look at the Wachowskis kind of, I know they have a lot of their favorite players. Like you get Hugo Weaving back in this, who had been in the Matrix films, and a lot of people who are in Sense8 are in this too, including her, I believe. And she is just phenomenal. And I think it's at the end when most of the storylines have kind of concluded and wrapped up, and you still get like little pieces of each of them. So it does still feel like, you know, you said one thing. But the moment that really stitches them together the best for me out of the whole film has to be when she's being read her last rites, Sunmi is, and you have the James Darcy character who learned that he has, you know, in the course of this film, he has had this great love that he presumably still, like, 40 years later, still loves. And because you talk about how, like, somebody mentions earlier that, like, death for him, he believes that love can live on after death, and his great love died 40 years ago. And then you have Sunmi saying to him, I'm still in love with this guy who died. And then he has the moment like, do you believe in like a heaven or hell? And she believes, I believe there will be a next place. And I believe like a door will open. I'll see him again. And then it cuts to the Pacific Island story. And this whole time you've been hearing about this guy, Adam Ewing, wanting to get back to his love, his wife, his like great love. And you haven't really seen her. You've seen maybe like a scratching of her, but they've been very smartly not showing you who that character is. And then when you see it's her, played by Donna Bay again, it hit me. It really, like, I got emotional because, and it's like the door opens and then he literally is there. And you've seen these great love stories play out in multiple lives, in multiple timelines. And it reminded me a lot of a movie that came out this year that I really liked called Past Lives. I feel like it's a very, very different movie, but kind of draws on the same themes. And they talk about like more hypothetically and stuff, but like, what if we are living our past lives and we'll meet in a future life and all that stuff. And when they just like run and are reunited, it feels so euphoric. That was for me, my favorite part of the whole movie. It was a great way to end a lot of the like intertwined stuff. As the movie was kind of wrapping up, do you have any favorite moments or things that really hit you like that?
Now that you bring that up, I guess my favorite ending to a story is, of course, it's the most tragic one. It's I love how you're like, oh, you know, I love that the romance and everything, but for me, I love the tragedy of it all. And it's Ben Whishaw's composer character, and his ending was just perfect sadness. I don't know. I love the tragedy. I love when it's like that, because like, when he's reading his letters to his lover, they're just so beautiful and they're so romantic, and he's just like, I loved you. And I'm like, he's like, I remember when I had my last cigarette, it reminds me of the time we were like under the stars and we had our first kiss or something. And he's like, and when he's saying that, he's like in the bathtub ready to put the gun in his mouth. And I just thought, I was like, man, this is so, like, it's so romantic. And then his lover's running up the stairs and he sees Tom Hanks' character with the waistcoat. And he's just like, oh, fuck. Like, you can see in his eyes that he's like, something's wrong. And he's running up. And unfortunately, the gunshot goes off, goes inside the room, and he finds him dead. And you're just like, fuck. It's like that. It's that, like, he was almost there. He could have almost saved him. He probably could have stopped him. But I just, I don't know. It just hit me in the feels, and it got me so upset. But at the same time, I just, it's kind of how, like, I love horror movies so much. I love, I tell my girlfriend this all the time. I'm like, I need the fear. The fear is like the perfect seasoning. I need that to enjoy a story sometimes for, like, horror. But sometimes when it's a film like this, when there's tragedy, that's the perfect seasoning for me, where I'm like, oh, yeah, that's delicious. It's sad, but it just hits so well for me. And I was like, oh, I love it. It's, I know it's fucked up, but I just no. love that tragedy. Like, it's just like, oh, dude, you were fucking there. Like, oh, and you wrote this beautiful piece that, like, transcended, like, time, you know, like, it's going throughout the movie and everything. And, like, oh, it was so good. I think, yeah, that, you know what? I think that might be my favorite. I think that's someone.
And that's too speaks to what you were saying earlier about, like, how you, it's hard to have a favorite card because it's all one thing. Because, like, that scene you mentioned, I think, like, it leads to, like, because I started getting very emotional, and then that leads directly into the scene that, like, both of those scenes are connected, and both of them are connected by James Darcy, who, like, if you don't have that same character playing that part of, like, this is this guy who's, like, held his boyfriend's head as he, like, was dead and he cradled him, it doesn't hit. And then that leads, like, and then you have the Jim Broadbent connecting with Susan Sarandon mixed in there too, and then it all ends with that epilogue of Tom Hanks and Halle Berry in the further future. So, like, it's they all are, all these great scenes which, like, work really well individually, are all pieces of this whole, in the same way that, yeah, like, once again, humanity is all just pieces of a whole. And that line that they mentioned two or three times, our lives are not our own. We are all connected by these invisible strings, and these moments that we think that we might just be nothing or that might not matter, they are all connecting everyone. And there's these things that make two people that might not ever think that they are going to ever cross paths, like, intrinsically linked. And I think that's what this film does so spectacularly. And two, one more thing I just wanted to say, like, the music, you mentioned the music, and it's one thing, it's interesting, because in the book, it's like, and this is, I read it, like, a little piece that the original author David Mitchell wrote for Wall Street Journal back when this was coming out, about how basically how he thought this was unfilmable and how hard it would be. And one of the things is, like, it's easy for me to write. He wrote a piece of music that was transcendent and amazing and incredible. And you're like, okay, cool. But it's another thing to actually have to, like, write that and hear it. Cause there's, like, you have to do that in a movie. And not only did they do that, like, it's a really great piece of music, but it's written by Tom Twilliker. Like, Tom Twilliker was like, oh yeah, I'll just direct this movie and I'll write this piece, which is, like, supposed to be, like, it's like in The Great Gatsby when F. Scott Fitzgerald's, like, he had a look on his face that it could only ever happen, like, twice in the history of a person's life or something. You're like, how do you act that? And it's the same thing with this. It's like, how do you write that music? But they do it. And I've listened to this score multiple times for the past couple of days. I don't know. What do you think about it? Do you think it's, like, a good score? Or?
I think it's a good score. I think, I mean, again, it's hard, man. Because, like, when you bring that up, it reminds me of this. I haven't seen it in, like, 20 years. There was this Japanese movie. It adapted a manga called Beck. And the manga was about a band, like, just, you know, band, you know, Japanese band or rock band, whatever, etc., trying to get big. And obviously when you read the manga, you don't, you know, you just see them playing and you're like, you're assuming that the music's great or whatever. And similar to, like, Scott Pilgrim, you read the comic book, you're just assuming it's great. And then, and this is this movie came out even, I think, before Beck, or before Scott Pilgrim. And I think the director just said, you know what? Fuck it. And he took a huge risk. And I think he just played nothing. I think he told his composers, don't make any music for when they're playing. Mm-hmm. And I remember this scene of one the character, the singer, whatever. He's like playing on the guitar and he's like just going hard, but it's silence. You don't hear anything. The crowd's
it's like tribute fucking by wild. Jack Black.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Tenacious D. It's just that, like, you just kind of have to imagine it. It's a big risk because your audience is going to be like, oh, what the fuck? Like, I don't know. And you kind of have to tell your audience, well, like, imagine it, I guess. And you're like, fuck, how do I do that? Like, I don't know. And it's like, well, that's your imagination. You got to figure it out. So it is very hard. And I dug it. But yeah, again, it's so hard to do something like that. I think it's rare. Like, I think Scott Pilgrim, you know, Edgar Wright, coincidentally, got Beck to write the music. And the manga is not nothing to do with Beck. I don't know why it was called Beck. Just purely coincidence. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that movie got the music really well done. It just fucking fit, especially because I saw it at the perfect age of like 20 years old. So I was like, yeah, this is fucking rad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for this film, yeah, it's so hard to do because you have to make it sound good from when it's written all the way until the future and when it's replayed, when Ben Whishaw's character's in the record store. It's like, yeah, I've been listening to it all the time. Like, you have to make it memorable enough where, like, Halle Berry's character is like, oh, yeah, I know this song. I know it. And it's a huge task. I would have liked Hans Zimmer to maybe have done the score just to see how he would have done it. Yeah, because the score is good.
He's the GOAT.
Good.
He is the GOAT.
Exactly. He's GOAT.
No offense to John Williams.
Yeah, no, they're both up there. They're both up there. Yeah. I love both of them. I would have loved to hear. I don't know if John Williams would have been able. I think his would have been too epic, but I think Hans Zimmer would have been like the perfect. Like he could figure it out, or just get John Carpenter and just make it a fucking synthesizer.
Just make it super like three notes.
Yeah, three notes. And it's like, oh, I got it. It transcends time and reincarnation and everything. It is just fucking the Halloween 3 theme. But yeah, no, I would have, you know, would have been really sick if they were able to, again, like you said, it's an indie movie, so it's a lot of money. But it would have been kind of cool to get like a couple of composers to just kind of like sit down and like Hans Zimmer, you know, John Williams. The one that I forgot his name. What's his name? Tyler, the composer for this one?
Oh, Tom Twilliker. So he's like the director, also composed it. And he did work with two other people too.
Oh, yeah. But like, imagine just having like big guys all be like, all right, let's figure this out kind of thing. Would have been pretty interesting. Like, just a collaboration. Because, I mean, that's the whole thing with Ben Whishaw's character and then Vivian being like, oh, we collaborated on it kind of thing, which it kind of was. Up until Vivian was fucking scumbag about it, but yeah, you know, I applaud them for it, and I applaud him for doing his best for it, because it's very hard to, like you said, it's from the text, so it's like, this sounds really fucking cool, and you're like, okay, I gotta figure that out.
Right, and I think that really speaks to just the ambition of this movie. Because, yeah, that's just one piece of them just being like, yeah, we're just going to make this, like, fucking insane epic of a movie that is going to be, like, it's going to be everything. And just the audacity of just, like, yeah, we're going to do it all. I really do think this might be the most ambitious movie ever made because of all the things it tries to tackle. Like, I wrote down what I think all the six genres are that it flawlessly, in my opinion, goes back and forth between. I think it's historical, epic, costume drama, spy thriller, British farce, action sci-fi, and then like a post-apocalyptic story. And I think it just weaves back and forth between all six of those with such skill. And I think that that's why, because it's so ambitious, because it was trying to achieve so much, I always will respect a movie like that. And I think that the first movie we ever talked about on Underrated was way back in the day, was Speed Racer, you know, the Wachowskis film right before this. And I think that they are always doing these big swings, ambitious movies, even like Jupiter Ascending, which I don't think worked for a lot of people. Parts of it didn't really work for me. I don't think it's a great movie, but I respect the hell out of that movie because they were really just, we're going to go for it. And they always do that. They always, even with their most recent Matrix movie, they were just like, it didn't work for me, all the parts, but they were trying to do something different and weird and really bold and interesting. And whenever you do that, I think it will be very, very divisive, because for people like me and like a lot of other, like, this was on a lot of critics, like top 10 lists and stuff like that. It was like people, like a lot of people really liked it, but at the same time, a lot of people really did not like it. A lot of people really hated this movie almost as strongly, to the point where, like, you know, we talked about how it had a rough, very rough box office. It lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of that seems maybe apparently like it might have been like there was like this really gnarly storm on the East Coast and like nobody could get to the movie theater for like a week or something like that. But I also think, yeah, it was just because it was so big and people were like, what even is this? But also there was a couple reputable journals and like magazines and stuff that named it, if not one of the worst movie of the year, including Time fucking magazine named this as the worst movie of 2012.
Wow,
which
shit.
Is, first of all, I kind of hate best of or worst of movie lists. Best of movie lists are great. Worst of movie lists, I think it's just like fuck that. Like, I hate those vibes. Like, it's just like, you know what, people worked hard on this movie, it didn't work for you, but whatever. But like, just to put that in context, that they named this the worst movie of 2012. Some other movies that came out in 2012 are That's My Boy, The Last Twilight Movie, House at the End of the Street, Battleship, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, Journey 2, The Mysterious Island, and Beverly Hills Chihuahua 3, and Taken 2. So you're telling me that this movie is worse than fucking Taken 2.
I mean... Beverly Hills Chihuahua deserves
Beverly Hills Chihuahua 3?
But there's all of them fucked up. I've never seen it like shit. But Cloud Atlas does not deserve there. Does not even exist around that. That's fucking insane, dude. Like, that's... It's just wild to me. Because I remember when it came out, I thought it had like a... I thought maybe it was mixed at most. Like, I thought maybe people were like, you know what? I think it's pretty good, and other people might have been like, you know what, I just didn't get it, which is completely understandable. Like, yeah, I get it, you know, because it is a movie you need to rewatch. But like, to be compared to Beverly Hills Chihuahua 3, get the fuck out of town, dude. That's fucking ridiculous. Like, taking whatever, fine. What was the other ones? Journey 2. A lot of them sound like popcorn movies. Fuck it.
Yeah, I just went on Letterboxd and looked up my lowest rated films from that year, and just lowest rated overall films from that year, because there's always going to be bad films every year, you know?
I really wonder what I have there. I'll check it later. But that's fucking wild to believe. But you know what, though? 2012, I remember everybody fucking hated everything that year.
Yeah, and I think it's a good year. I think it's a solid year for movies, to be honest.
Yeah, I remember Dark Knight Rises came out and fucking everybody was shitting on that. And I was like, the fuck? Where'd this come from?
Mm-hmm.
And then what else was out? There was some more stuff that came out there where, I think Avengers was the only thing people were like, masterpiece. Which it was a great, you know, start to all that. That's fucking wild, though, dude. There's no fucking way. Like, I really think it's just... And we weren't even into the heavy part of the MCU, where like from 2012 to like maybe just a couple years ago, people were just like, anything the MCU does is fucking gold kind of thing.
Hmm.
Like, we were still like right before that. So it boggles my mind that people would be like, yeah, this shit was fucking trash. And like it went fucking hard for what it is. Like, it's just like, it's like you said, it really, really swung for the fences. And for me personally, I think it hit a home run. I think it's a phenomenal film.
Thank you. I'm glad you agree, because like, I completely agree. I think this, like, going into this, I was like, is this film like as good as I remember? And then I watched it and I was like, no, it's better than I remember. This film's a fucking like stone cold masterpiece for me.
I agree. Yeah, honestly, yeah. Like, when I was starting it earlier, I was just kind of like I said, I didn't hate it when I finished it the first, when I saw it in theaters. I was just like, all right, I didn't want to talk shit, or but I didn't also not want to praise it. I was just like, I need to see it again. I want to give it another try. I want to be fair. And I never got around to it. But this time, actually sitting down and rewatching, and I was like, oh, fuck, dude, like, this shit is dope. You really got to give it a chance. And I think nowadays, I hope this movie gets put on, like, streaming. It's on streaming, but you have to, like, rent it and all that. But I hope maybe it gets put on, like, free streaming, like Netflix or whatever, and gives people a chance to, like, give it a try, especially now with everybody being able to, like, binge so much shows. Because I think right when this came out, that's where, like, the big binging boom happened. From, like, 2010 to 2012, that was, like, the transitionary period of people, like, going, oh, dude, I'm watching fucking Lilyhammer, whatever the fuck, and, like, just, dude, whatever the fuck was around at that time, like, kind of binging stuff little by little, and they're like, you know, Sherlock just popped up, and people are like, this Sherlock show's pretty fucking good, like, it just showed up, I don't know, for us here in the States, and it was like, okay, and that's when people started binging. I think if they release it now, and just maybe even cut it up into three episodes on Netflix or something, I think it would get a lot of people following it. I think a lot of people would appreciate it more. Because it really is that type of film you gotta, like, you can, like, sit down and binge it kind of thing. I think it's just when it came out, it was just too long for people. I think at the time a lot of people were like, I like my, like, movies an hour to 2 hours tops.
But yeah, what you're saying, you know, I think that, yeah, 2012 was, like, the year, like you said, the Dark Knight trilogy wrapped up. It was the first Avengers film. And I think that if this movie were to come out now, a lot of those same critics, like Time, I think that, like, Time Magazine and a lot of these places that shit on it would be like, oh my God, this film's a revelation. Because now all those places are like, you know what? They're right about this, where they're like, all the movies, all the big blockbusters are like part of these franchises. They're based superhero ones, or they're like video game ones, or they're reboots of things from the 80s or whatever. All the big, like, they're just like another Tom Cruise movie and like the mission of, like, they're all these big franchises that have existed for 15 years. There's not any, like, original stuff. Like, it's kind of all those big budget movies have really gone away. So, like, I think that if you saw a movie that was ambitious with scope and talent behind it and all that, and it came out today, Time Magazine and all these guys would be praising the fuck out of it. But I think at the time, being ambitious was almost like a bad thing to them. Because, you know what? Because I said, you know what their second worst movie they named was? Because it was another very, very ambitious movie, and it's one we covered back in the day.
Which one?
John Carter. Which is not as good as this movie.
Right. You're right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's another really fucking ambitious movie where that is trying to be different and big and bold, and it's not based on another franchise. It's just like this, they spent a lot of money to, like, make this thing. And rather than being like, okay, wow, this was cool, it didn't work for me, I didn't like these things about it, but I respect it, they're like, worst movie of the year, fuck that.
Yeah, it's so funny because I feel like a lot of those people nowadays, like you said, they're going to look at everything that's out right now. Superhero fatigue, fucking Marvel's bringing something out every other minute, Star Wars is bringing something out. As much as I love them, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
DC, legacy sequels, fucking everyone's making something. Like, there's just, right now, Five Nights at Freddy's just fucking came out, and now it's like killing it at the box office. And I'm just like, okay, cool, you know, yeah, sweet, but it's always kind of the same thing where it's like, if yeah, you're right. If this had came out maybe this year or even last year, I think a lot of people would have been like, fuck yeah, something fresh, something different, something like with big scope. And yeah, I think it would have flourished a lot better. I even think if the Wachowskis decided they hadn't made it back then and were like, we're going to make it now with all the same actors and everything, they're all still around, everything's great, and did that instead of Matrix 4, I think it would have done way fucking better than Matrix 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Wachowskis, they got their blank check from the Matrix movies. And then they were just like, they made a bunch of movies that I think two of them are two of my favorite films of all time. And another one I respect a lot, which is, we've mentioned him, Speed Racer, this one, and Jupiter Ascending. And they all lost a shit ton of money. And then they kind of put the Wachowskis in director jail. And basically the only way for them to get out was making another Matrix movie. So, which only one of them ended up doing, and the other one is essentially retired now. So yeah, Lana, who made the Matrix Resurrections. So it's a shame.
Yeah, I remember seeing the credits just having one, but yeah, it's a shame, man. Like, I feel like it just sucks. It just sucks that, like, yeah, they got put in director jail because, like, they have ideas. I think it's just what sucks is that the Matrix was just the perfect fucking timing. It was perfect fucking timing. Lightning in a bottle. It came out exactly when it needed to. The whole fucking aesthetic of that first Matrix movie is late 90s, early 2000s, fucking black leather vibe, fucking industrial music, hacking, computers, everything. Like, that was literally just the perfect timing. And what sucks is that all these other films, I think, just came out right before or right after they were supposed to.
Yeah.
Like, it boggles my fucking mind that Speed Racer wasn't as fucking huge as it should have been. Because even when I saw it, and everybody I went to go watch it with, like, you know, go back, episode one, you guys hear me say this over there. We all had a fucking blast. We all thought this was going to be like fucking, what was it, like 2008 it came out? We thought it was going to be like probably one of the top best films of the year, like top grossing. I mean, it wasn't going to be Dark Knight. But we were like, it's going to be fucking up there. Because it was hype as fuck. And I think it might have just came out a little too early. I bet if it came out early 2010s, it would have fucking killed it.
Yeah, I think that's something, yeah, we were saying definitely about Speed Racer. And I think it applies here is that, yeah, just sometimes the timing on these things is just so important. And unfortunately, you know, the Wachowskis have had rough luck when it's come to that, because I think they are true visionaries, honestly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about something you said earlier, that we kind of went on a lot of different courses, but you mentioned that you had a couple favorite characters from this movie. Who were some of your favorites?
First one, Hugh Grant as a cannibal. I liked Ben Whishaw as the composer. I liked, I forgot her name, something Bay.
Donna Bay, yeah.
Donna Bay, she was phenomenal in the Neo Soul.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the British Farce, I liked, there's a lot in that one. A lot of them were really great.
Yeah.
The main guy, Hugh Grant again in that. And then I liked Jim Sturgess as like the Scottish hooligan.
Yeah.
And then there was somebody else in that one. Oh, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks' character in that one. The guy who wrote the Knuckle Sandwich book.
Oh, yeah.
He fucking... I was really upset the first time I saw it. Because he kind of stole the show. And then he fucking disappeared. And I was like, oh, man. Even though his acting, you know, his accent wasn't the best. I was like, dude, that shit was pretty funny. What else is there? Halle Berry killed it in her... like 70s one. Keith David was really good in that one as well. Hugo Weaving, I think, was great in fucking everything.
Yeah.
Like, he was phenomenal in everything.
It's like different. He's sinister in each of them, but it's like a different kind of sinister each time. You know, like, yeah. One of them, he's almost like doing Agent Smith in one of them, and then he's like doing like V for Vendetta character in another, and then he's like basically being Nurse Ratchet in the Forest one. He's so good.
The speech he does at the end of the Pacific Island one was straight out of the Matrix. I feel like the Wachowskis are like, you did great on this, you did great as this, da da da. But at that last final fucking scene, right when Jim Sturgess' character is like, you know, fuck this, I'm not going to do this, throws the thing in the fire. He has a speech just right out of the Matrix. Like, just like, what the fuck are you doing? It's like, you know, I thought it was just going to be like, the smell. I hate this smell. I need to leave. Or whatever. You know, the whole fucking monologue in the Matrix. But yeah, he was fucking great. But yeah, I think absolute favorite character has to be... Oh, it's so tough. I think it's Ben Whishaw as a composer. I think that one had to be my favorite.
Yeah,
what about you?
he's pretty great. I like him a lot. I think, though, for me, Robert Frobisher is that character's name, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like all the ones you've mentioned are pretty great. I think my favorites are Adam Ewing, you know, so the main character in the Pacific Island ones, the Jim Sturgess character, and then the Donna Bay Somni 451 character in Neo Soul. And so I think that, you know, I just love both of them. And so I think that's even more why that ending that kind of linked them and their like past lives intertwined love story worked even more. And there's even more little moments that just tie those characters together. So cool. Like, I don't know if you noticed in the credits, but as they mentioned Sixsmith, his niece, and she has like a picture that you see for like a split second. A fucking split second, and it's the two of them that play your pair.
Yeah, dude, what the fuck? I was like, when did this happen? Like, I was so confused. And then thank you for bringing that up, because I was just like, did I miss that? Or what the fuck? But yeah, okay. That's where it was.
Yeah, just the amount of just insane stuff they are able to slip in that movie and to make you resonate with these characters, and these characters that go on arcs that, you know, over multiple lives or reincarnations or however you want to take it over hundreds of years, how, you know, Tom Hanks starts as this insane murderer and then he becomes a guy who's like pushes somebody out a window, you know, that great part. And then he ends up going on that arc that he goes through on the big island in the post-apocalyptic future in the true when he becomes the main character and goes on this quest and helps, you know, save Halle Berry and all of her people. And then also just, I love that the way Hugo Weaving, and it's like that. That's another wrinkle. It's like, is this past lives or what is this? How Hugo Weaving like plays a figment of his imagination. Like, I think that was so. And he's just like, oh, no, Georgia here. Like, mm-hmm. Whatever the fuck he's doing, I just love. I don't know, man. I gotta rewatch.
I was wondering if Hugo Weaving's character in that one is Old George or something like that, right?
Old Georgia.
I thought maybe he was like someone his character knew or something. Maybe someone he thought, like, maybe that character died or something and he was someone so important to him where like he kind of used them as his like conscience almost.
That's like the template for like what he imagines the devil to be. Yeah,
exactly. So I was like, maybe he knew him, because I was like, I don't want it to be that, like, because I like the idea that everyone was a past or future life. Mm-hmm. So I kind of kept thinking, because like when he sees him the first time, he's like, oh, Georgie, like it was like, oh God, I know that guy. So mm-hmm. I wonder if it's somebody he knew at one point in time and that guy died or something or whatever. And he just used that as like his, like you said, like his devil on his shoulder kind of thing. So yeah, I like to believe that person was alive and he was just like a scumbag, but for some reason, because it kind of makes me think maybe he kind of taught Tom Hanks' character to be like, you know, look out for yourself or whatever. And that's why he hides behind the rock and Jim Sturgess' character gets murdered. And I feel like he's always kind of had that as like, well, he's taking care of me, I survived. And now even having him as my like my morality kind of thing. Maybe
evil Jiminy
good.
Cricket.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, he has the fucking top hat. You're right. Yeah. So that makes sense. Yeah.
Could yeah. Yeah. And that's one thing I love too, is that is open to interpretations like that. Cause that's a completely valid interpretation. I never would have thought of that though, you know? And cause they don't say like, oh, these are definitely past lives, or like they're all like different versions. Like they all have that star, the JoJo star or whatever. And mm-hmm. they keep, you know, or is that the same person? But you're like, that doesn't line up either necessarily, because, and I guess which that's more of what, because that's how I took it when I first saw the movie. It was like, oh, the main character is the one who's getting reincarnated. And then these other people around him are like other versions of himself, or like related to past versions of himself. It's kind of how I took it. But and that's apparently how the book was, except for like one person, which I guess would probably have to be the Timothy Cavendish, because the ages don't line up at all. But he also has the star too, so it's like it leaves things open to interpretation like that. And it's vague isn't the right word, more of just like, I can't even think of the word, but just
because the way I thought about the one thing mm-hmm. that would have made me kind of laugh, and I thought would have been kind of funny, is if like at one point, because you know they're all reincarnated, Mm-hmm. And in some religions, it's believed, like, you know, oh, if you're a horrible fucking person, you'll come back as a cockroach or something. And then if you're a great person, you'll come back as a cow in India or something. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be taken care of and everything. So I kind of thought of it as, like, you know, like, I think the big one they were trying to get into you was Jim Sturgess's hooligan character from the British farce of being like, he's not really connected to anything. It's just purely coincidence that his reincarnated life was there. And I kind of thought of that as like, yeah, that would make perfect sense of like, yeah, somehow they're connected. Just like a little similarly to JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. In JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, they have powers called stands. And stand users typically somehow always run into each other. It's just what happens. They're always going to run into each other. So I thought of it as a sense of like, even though they're all connected throughout their lives and time, maybe they're not always going to be connected directly. Maybe just like that the publisher character was like, I never ran into this Jim Sturgess dude my whole fucking life until like I'm old. And then Hugo Weaving's character, you know, all that stuff. So I kind of thought of it as like, yeah, it can virtually happen anytime. It doesn't have to necessarily follow a certain flow because people are born every day, every second, and people die every day and every second. So I kind of thought of it as like, it's just random, but these souls, these lives will somehow cross paths, even if it's just for like a moment at a bar watching a fucking rugby match or some shit.
Yeah,
that's the way I thought of it.
No, then that makes it, because like, yeah, I think I was trying, where I was trying to think of was more ambiguous, which I still think it is. But yeah, what you're saying makes sense, because it also reminded me of another show, you know, that's very big in my life, where it is also about these characters who have crossed over throughout their whole lives. And some of them have big connections, and some of them like will show up for a second in each other's pasts, and then they're all get brought together, and that's Lost. You know, they all are end up on this island together, but then throughout, you know, the show's flashbacks, you'll be like, oh shit, that was Boone in the background of Jack's flashback, or that was Sawyer getting, he knew Jack's dad who knew Anna Lucia. Like, everyone was all connected, and they all kind of finally come together here at the end. But it's like, maybe they have all these people who seem to have nothing to do with each other have actually been connected their entire lives, and it's all leading to this, you know, then they all are together on the island. That's what it reminded me of. But instead of just being like one life, it's like over lifetimes, over reincarnations, over all these different centuries of just intertwining and meeting here. And it goes back to, once again, that movie I was talking about earlier, Past Lives. There's a part where they're talking about, they use a specific term in it, which, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but about like, even if it's like, yeah, we met on like a subway and we like shook hands or something like that, you know, that's one thing. And then we'll meet again in the next life and it'll be another thing. And, you know, after a thousand times of meeting in our lives, like, we'll get married one day. So that's something that it Hawk really Man reminded me of.
That's that's Hawkman and Hawk Girl. Their abilities are like, they fucking die and they meet each other, reincarnate, blah, blah, blah. They're not my favorites, but you kind of remind me of that for a second.
It's good to have Alan back, because we can go back to the underrated classics of me talking about Lost and Alan talking about DC.
Absolutely. Where can I find it? You know what, though? This is, I think, the first time I've ever brought up JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which I'm a huge fucking fan on, and I'm a huge fan of, and I'm very shocked. In all the fucking hundreds of episodes we've done, I don't think I ever brought it up once. I'm very shocked.
That's true.
That.
Yeah, I don't think you ever have. I've heard you bring it up in real life, and I've heard you, like, you've mentioned your cat JoJo, which is, of course, named after.
Yeah, he's named after JoJo Cujo. And I'm like, what the? Well, hey, you know what? I'm glad this was the episode of Bring It Back.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Bring It On.
Yeah, I'm really glad that, because, you know, I was like, I always, because when I started doing new episodes on my own and having different guest hosts on, I was like, I gotta save Cloud Atlas for Alan, because I know Alan's gonna be back at some point, and I gotta keep that one in my back pocket, because I knew we would have a good discussion on it, and I think we really have, because you've always got unique insights on these, especially these big swing movies that we do.
I just love it. I just love talking about it, and I love these types of movies. I feel like I don't like hating on films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, yes, there's a handful that I go, I really don't fucking like that. But most of the time, I try and find joy out of everything I watch and be like, you know what, I like that. Even before we were recording Pope's Exorcist, we were talking about Pope's Exorcist, and like, I didn't hate it. I don't think I hated it. I was just like, yeah, it's all right. It's fine. You know, it's fun. You know, Russell Crowe killed it or whatever. So when I see something like this, it's very ambitious and really aims for the fences kind of thing. I just go, man, it's something you got to talk about. It's something you got to just be like, man, how the fuck, like, do not more people like this? Or why is it not in, like, you know, the zeitgeist? It's so fucking good kind of thing. So, and I just want to appreciate all the people that worked on it. Filmmakers, the writers, producers, the cast and crew, everybody. Like, I'm like, man, like, you guys really made something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I would rather watch a movie that is very ambitious, and obviously one that works like this, but even one that doesn't work, like Jupiter Ascending, I would much rather watch that than something that just plays it safe, plays it down the middle, like mm-hmm. Five Nights at Freddy's or something like that, which is a movie that was totally fine. It was whatever. But, like, I would rather watch Jupiter Ascending any day of the week than that. And because you have the potential, like Five Nights at Freddy's, I mean, if you're a fan and you love it, like good, great. I'm not trying to shit on it, but like, it's not like, you're
it's
not,
okay. That movie's
not,
they're all kids, dude. All the family kids. True. Anyways, not shitting on the kids, you know, yeah. Just, yeah, you know, I didn't see it. You know, I know I'll get to it. I'm not in a rush.
But that movie's never going to be like a masterpiece. But anytime mm-hmm. you're just like, let's swing for the fences, it's always going to be a double. Like, to go back to your baseball terminology, that movie's always going to be a double. This movie, you can strike out, but maybe you'll get a home run. And this one absolutely was.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just like how, you know, I was telling you guys last year when we had been ranking our films, there's the you know, Terrifier 2. I was kind of like really excited to go see it. And I didn't think it would be, like, my number one. Like, it fucking shot up because, all the while, yes, it wasn't, like, different or anything like that. But I just was impressed by how just these filmmakers with a small budget were able to be like, we're going to go fucking hard, because I appreciate what they knew. They were like, we know makeup, we know gore, we know slashers, we know horror. And that's what we're going to focus on. And we're going to go fucking hard. And they fucking did. And they knocked it out of the park with it. Yeah, some people are going to be like, oh, acting's kind of shitty. It's a very, you know, nothing new. But I just go, dude, but they fucking tried. And that's something I give so much props to, is when the filmmakers are like, we're going to fucking go ham on this, dude. Just like this film. You know, no offense to Five Nights at Freddy's or anything like that. And even then, it has its haters that are like, oh, I wish it was like the fucking games. The fucking games are staring at a fucking screen the whole time. I don't know what the fuck you guys wanted. Just a guy staring at a fucking security camera? Cool. That's fine. But, you know, again, no offense to that. But, like, they already had the source material right there. And they're like, we just got to do this, this, and this. And I applaud them. They did a great job. They're doing great at the box office. Happy for them. But this film, Cloud Atlas, really was like, let's fucking do something new. Six stories, actors being used, all this makeup, you know, hit or miss makeup, whatever you want to call it. It's still so impressive that they went out of the way to make something so big that wasn't based on a comic book property, not based on a video game or a legacy sequel, nothing like that. They're like, yes, it's based on a book, and that's it. That's mm-hmm. what we're going fucking with. So you got to applaud it.
Yeah, I absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I can't put it better than that. So, I mean, before we wrap up, any final thoughts, anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't mention about Cloud Atlas?
No, I think I'm good. I think I feel like I've said a lot about it.
Yeah, there's a lot to say, and like I said, I think this is a movie that really benefits from rewatches, because mm-hmm. I remember watching it and I was like, cool, I need to go watch this again. You said this, I know you said the same thing. It's like, because it is a movie that you like pick up on, so even like little things. One I was going to mention that I forgot to mention is, like, there's this point when it's like a joke in Farce Time where he goes, Soylent Green is people, you know, which is like, it's like a British farce. It's referencing this like British movie. And he's like, oh, you're like, you know, it's like you're pod people, whatever. But then that comes back in like a way where it's like, oh, they're doing this Soylent Green thing because they're feeding, I forget the name of the replicants.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's replicants. Right. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And it's yeah, something she never even said before. That she's like, they're feeding us. They're feeding us to ourselves. Holy shit. See, and that's another beautiful part about is that like, it's a great discussion film. It's an absolutely wonderful discussion film because you would pick up on something and then someone else would pick up on something. And that's the fun of it. I feel like one of the best things about film is like talking about them at the end of the day. That's why we all do this. That's why we all watch movies and watch TV and do these podcasts is because we love to talk about films. And when you have a film that has such a great replayability and such a great, like, so many great topics to talk about, like, oh, did you see this? Did you notice this? It's so much fun because you go, oh shit, I didn't see that. Like right now, this whole time when you were bringing all these things up, I was like, oh my God, dude, that didn't even click. I didn't even think about that. You know, yeah. Like, and real fast, like, I know, again, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to shit on Five Nights at Freddy's, and I get it, you know, when you go watch it, you know, the gamers, the people who are really into it, they're going to be like, oh, fuck, that's fucking Freddy Fazbear, and that's fucking the chicken, I don't know what the fuck they are. Willy's Wonderland was the fucking shit, so I really love that movie. I thought that was a better one already, but anyways, yeah, and that's cool to be like, hey, I saw that, you know, you go watch a Marvel movie or Star Wars or something, and they're like, hey, he said the fucking thing from the comic, or fucking, hey, in Star Wars he said, I love you, yeah, I know, or whatever. It's fucking cool. That stuff's great, don't get me wrong. I fucking live for that too, you know. I love it when they do little callbacks. But for me, that's kind of like the fast food of it. It's kind of like, oh yeah, cool, you know, that's fun. But then with this, when you walk out of a movie and he goes, oh my God, did you fucking notice this and this and this? When there's still things you haven't discovered that are brand fucking new, and you say something and this person doesn't say something, it's so fucking fun, man. It makes the film even better.
Yeah, it even really adds a layer.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, because I remember watching this movie like back in the day, and just my friends would talk about like, what do you think this was? And this person came back here. Well, what was this? Like, just it's so rewarding to have a film that lets you, that is not just so surface level like that, where there's all these details that really, it does. It's not just like, okay, cool, here's, let's eat some popcorn and watch it and then not think about it again. It's a film that makes you think about your like entire fucking life afterward, mm-hmm. and talk about everything that you just spent the last 3 hours watching a big screen. So that's the power of cinema, honestly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to think of it. Back to the Future 2, real fast, just to kind of bring it back. The beauty about replayability is this was obvious to a lot of people, but it took me like fucking 10 years to figure it out. And just real fast, I had seen that trilogy so many fucking times. It's my favorite trilogy of all time. And not until like I was in my late teens, Marty McFly's daughter in Back to the Future 2, I didn't know it was played by Michael J. Fox for the longest time. And like, he even does this thing in the movie where he's like, mom, like he just does this, like, it's very obvious to the camera, like going, hey, that's Michael J. Fox. And for some fucking reason, it never clicked. And I was like, oh shit, that's him.
And they needed to.
That's the beauty of cinema, especially something like that, where like you just go, "Oh shit, I didn't notice that," and this is my billionth time watching that. And the same thing with this. Yeah,
yeah. I was just gonna say they needed to have like a closing credits where they just do have like how they had like Tom Hanks and they showed all the different people he played. Just do that for Marty McFly. Just like have him like show all the different McFly family members.
Absolutely. I mean, they kind of did something like that in the game, the quote unquote Back to the Future 4 type of game. But oh man, yeah, that's. But yeah, see, that's the fun. Like you said, the fun of cinema is like rewatching stuff and just finding something new and be like, oh, and discussing it. It's fun.
Yeah, it's a blast, and that's why I fucking love doing film podcasts. You know, and it's like. Missed having you on. Good to have you back and talking about all this stuff.
Thank you, man. No, it feels good to be back.
And well, since you're back, I was wondering, you know, because you know, I've had to be like Thanos and do it myself recently. But do you have a question at the end here?
Oh my God! Yeah, I forgot about that. A question. That's right. I had a lot of questions back then.
You were like the Riddler, or the Riddler. You just had so many questions. Yeah, the Riddler.
I guess I didn't even think about it. I usually think about it on the fly, but like when we're discussing stuff. But oh man,
I can give you one. I can give you one if you want.
Go for it. Yeah, go for it.
All right. So I was thinking. You know, we talked a lot about how this was a really big, ambitious movie, like a big swing. And we've covered a few of them before, but do you have any other big swings that maybe we haven't talked about that you really love?
Big swings.
Well, I'll give you one while you think.
Yeah.
Because we've covered a lot of these movies, you know, and there's some that like work in varying degrees, you know, like I think Pan is kind of a mess, but it works. Pacific Rim is probably one of the most successful ones, I think, of these that was a really big swing. But I don't know if you saw this, but last year's George Miller's 3,000 Years of Longing. It's a really, really just bizarre big swing of a movie that I'm pretty mixed on. I probably should rewatch it again, but I do respect the hell out of the movie.
I haven't seen it.
I would recommend. I think you'd enjoy it.
I'd be down to check it out. Yeah, I've been trying to get back into it, trying to watch a lot of stuff. I guess they're doing well, but I think the idea of it being a big swing, or it has the idea of being a big swing, was X and Pearl, where Ty West. He kind of like disguised, you know, he's like, I'm going to do X or whatever. And then he kind of was like, I'm actually going to do two movies in one, which I thought was a fucking, in that, just that concept itself is a big swing, because like, I think Ty West is a great director. House of the Devil is a fucking great slow burn horror film. And Keepers is pretty good too. But I thought him being like, I'm going to release two movies the same fucking year and they're going to be related. And he's like, I'm going to put X out first. And it did well. And I'm like, damn, that's a huge fucking gamble to be like, I already made two movies and I haven't even told anybody I made the second one yet. Which is a prequel, Pearl. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also going out of his way. Dude, they're fucking great. But also to go out of his way and be like, X is a slasher, like a typical slasher movie. And Pearl being like, the genres are slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Pearl being more of this like golden age character study, a little bit slashery, while like X is more of like a Texas Chainsaw kind of slasher flick. And I loved Pearl. Pearl actually made me fucking cry. Pearl was so fucking good. Mia Goth immediately went up in my like tier of like best actresses. But I think for me, those two, the concept of being like, I'm going to make two movies, that I think that's a huge swing. And both doing very well. And then now he's doing Maxine, I think is phenomenal. Like, I'm shocked. I'm like, damn, dude, you really went all in.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, that's a great answer, honestly. I would not have even have thought of that. But yeah, Alan, thank you. Thank you for coming back and coming back on the show and talking about this one with me. I had a blast talking about this underrated movie, waiting to do it. So I'm glad we finally got the opportunity here to talk about it. I don't know. I know you've been away for a minute. Is there anything you have been doing that you want to tell the listeners about or anything?
Not at all. I've been doing shit. I've been just chilling. You know what? My October, I was like, I just want to watch horror movies. And that was it. Nothing That's crazy, fair. Just working. But you know what? I'd be down to come back again, do another movie. Maybe in the future something's coming up. I've been thinking about it. I'm not in a rush or anything. I've just been kind of like, I've been trying to find my love again for movies, because I feel like for a while I couldn't watch as much as I wanted to. Because of like work and just life and everything. And I had some health issues, so I just wasn't really in the mood. I think that's what kind of affected a lot of things. But now I'm really just trying to get back into it. I'm just trying to be like, I want to fall back in love with movies like I used to. You know, I never fell out, but I just now want to really be like, just want to just watch movies kind of thing. I think that's all I'm trying to do.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you're definitely going to be back on, I'm sure, at, you know, many, many more times. So, you know, yeah, well, this is definitely not the only time. So I'm excited. I'll probably pitch something after we stop recording here, because I always plan things really far in advance and I have some ideas. But yeah.
Absolutely.
But yeah, just to wrap it up here, just for anybody who's listening, first of all, thank you all for listening. Should mention to everyone that there is, of course, if you want to get any more info about the show or check out any past episodes or anything, we're on all the podcast apps, Spotify, Apple, back on YouTube now. Got a YouTube. If you want to check that out, it's Underrated Movie Podcast. Just look that up anywhere, underratedmoviepodcast.com. We've got a bunch of new stuff in the pipes. Actually, the show is going to be kind of getting a bit of a rebrand starting on the new year, starting with the start of 2024. There's going to be kind of a new logo, new artwork, all that stuff. It's just kind of time for the show to get a fresh coat of paint. And yeah, there's a Substack now. And then, of course, we've got the new Patreon, which I should also mention, starting on the first of the year, going to be getting an official title, Underrated Disc 2. That is where Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones is going to be living. If you sign up for just $1 a month, you can get my MCU podcast there. If you sign up for $3, you can also get another bonus podcast, Underdogs, where once a month I talk about sports films. And if you sign up for $5 a month, you get all of that, plus all the bonus videos and all the other bonus stuff. And you also get to pick a movie for us to cover here on Underrated every 6 months. So go ahead and sign up on patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast. Any of that sounds enticing to you. If not, you know, just we appreciate you listening. If you can give us 5 stars, that really helps the show out quite a bit. And then one other thing I just want to mention is that the show, I'm going to be moving the date of the show from switching Mondays, essentially. So there's going to be our Christmas episode to wrap up this year, which will be covering Anna and the Apocalypse. Had on art from a Cozy Christmas podcast, or have on art from a Cozy Christmas podcast, to talk about the zombie Christmas musical, which is a lot of fun. And then the Monday after that, it's going to be the new shiny paint of Underrated, and we'll be talking about a new movie or a movie on that day. So 2 days in a row to kind of put us back on the original schedule that Underrated used to come out before it shifted way in the past, going back to that original Monday. And also, because I do another movie podcast too, I do the movie podcast, it's called now the Midnight Film Society. So now I'll be on alternating Mondays. So one Monday will be Underrated and the Mondays without Underrated. If you're not tired of listening to me, you can listen to the Midnight Film Society, where me and Damien talk about more recent film news and film reviews and all that good stuff. But yeah, that's the end of my long spiel. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And Alan, one more time, thank you again for coming back on here with me. It's been a blast.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, well, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. And well, take it easy.
I'll see you in another life.